Hey guys, my name is Sabir Bharti. A very, very warm welcome to another episode of the Sabir Bharti Show, the place where I interview interesting people with interesting perspectives. My guest today is Emily Thoreau Threat. That's spelled Emily Thoreaux, Threatt, on Twitter at Threat Emily. On Instagram at Emily underscore Thoreau underscore Threat. And I will, as always, include all of the other social media links in both the YouTube and the audio podcast description. Following the passing away of two husbands, family members, and friends, Emily says that she has since learned how to navigate the path of grieving, allowing her to face life with love, optimism, and joy. Emily's ultimate mission is to comfort and support others who are on their own journey of dealing with loss and grief. Today, Emily is the host of the Grief and Happiness podcast. She holds a master's in English with a concentration in writing and is the author of Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief, a comprehensive guide to reclaiming and cultivating joy and carrying on in the face of loss. Emily is also the founder of the Grief and Happiness Alliance, an online platform in which members come together weekly for teachings on how to navigate the path of loss and grief through writing and happiness practices. To find out more about Emily's story, you can visit her website, which is lovingandlivingyourwaythroughgrief.com. That's lovingandlivingyourwaythroughgrief.com. Emily, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you.
Aloha, I'm so happy to be here.
Aloha to you as well. And I do actually love that greeting. And it's a greeting that I've often heard on social media when watching and listening to people who are in your part of the world, which is, of course, Hawaii. And if I'm not mistaken, you're in Maui at the moment. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And there's a very nice ring to Aloha. It sounds very upbeat and very bubbly. Even when we were engaging on email over the last few weeks, you open the conversation with Aloha, and there's certainly something very uplifting about it. Do you get that sense as well, since you've been in that part of the world?
I really do. The translation of aloha is essentially love and breath. So it's the breath of life, the breath of love. And
Wow.
when Hawaiian people, the Native Hawaiians, will greet each other, instead of just saying aloha, what they do is they come and press their foreheads together and breathe the breath of life together. And
Wow.
that's their expression of aloha, which I think is quite beautiful.
It is beautiful and profound. I didn't actually know the meaning behind that, so I really appreciate you explaining that for us. Thank you so much. Now, Emily, before we begin the conversation, I just wanted to offer my condolences for your losses over the past few years. As I mentioned in the introduction, you experienced significant losses in your life. Two instances were, of course, two of your husbands and then family members and friends. So from the bottom of my heart, I do offer my condolences.
Thank you.
So I wanted to actually start, Emily, if I may, by asking you about a book by the name of Happy for No Reason. Could you perhaps give us an insight into the significance of this book in your life?
Oh, it's very significant in my life. After Jacques, who was my first husband to die, had passed, I was very unhappy. Not so much unhappy as void of kind of feelings. I just wasn't sure where to go or what to do, and I spent a lot of time by myself and just wasn't making any progress and wasn't really motivated to. I just didn't know what to do. And two different friends of mine were concerned about me, and they both suggested that I watch the movie The Secret. And I thought, that's not my kind of thing, you know. I don't want to do that. But both of them, on different instances, really encouraged me. And I thought, wouldn't hurt. So I watched it. And one of the people on there, one was Michael Beckwith from Agape International Spiritual Center, who turned out to be a childhood friend of my husband, Ron. And but it was my first introduction to Michael Beckwith. And another person, and Jack Canfield was on it, who the Chicken Soup for the Soul man, who's brilliant and incredibly kind, and Marcy Shymoff. And Marcy Shymoff wrote Happy for No Reason. So after I watched the movie, it suggested writing a gratitude list. And I thought, oh, come on, you know, but then I thought, why am I fighting trying to make positive changes in my life right now? So I just started writing the list, and I actually got hooked on writing things that I was grateful for. And as a writer, it's nice to have some sort of a hook that you get into that you can deal. And I was just amazed that I kept being more grateful. And the more grateful I was, I realized I was starting to smile again and I felt better. And then I ran across Marcy's book, which is called Happy for No Reason. And I read that, and Marcy was a sad child, just kind of born sad. And it took her quite a while up into adulthood to realize that she didn't have to be that way. That just, she thought was just her natural personality. So she started researching what happiness is, and she got stories from people that she interviewed all over the world and figured out a way to explain happiness and then different things that you could do to increase your happiness. And I thought, well, that's what I need right now. So I read it, and it was beautiful. I was so glad that I read it. And then I was actually able to put a lot of what was in the book into practice in my life. And after Ron died, I did much better after Ron died. The circumstances were very different between the two husbands. And I was trying to figure out what to do, and I started writing about it because, as you mentioned, I'm a writer. I've written 3 college textbooks in addition to Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief. So it was just natural to me to write about my grief and what I was experiencing and what I was doing. And so I, in doing that, I found things that were really helpful to me, and I thought, I've got to share this. So I didn't really know that many people on Maui at that point. We'd only lived here for 2 years, and those last 2 years with Ron were lots of being together and taking care in doctors and hospitals and all that sort of thing. So I thought, who would I teach this to? So I put on Meetup, an app online that if people wanted to learn how to write in a way that could help them with grief, to come on over to my house on this date and time. And they came. I was so surprised. All these different people came. It seemed like something that people were seeking, and they wanted to. And we became a kind of close-knit group that did very well till the pandemic. And most of them weren't terribly computer savvy and weren't interested. They were interested in the person-to-person thing. So I didn't want to stop. So I took it online and developed a whole new group of people, and while still staying in touch with my friends here on Maui. And then I wrote my book, another story for how the book happened to come to be. But once it came to be and I was working on marketing the book, I kept thinking there's something missing, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So I happened to notice it. One of those things that came to me, because it was supposed to, online, something about the Happy for No Reason certified trainer program that Marcy Shymoff had, that she put together. And instantly I said, that's what's missing. We're dealing with grief, but the whole point is to be able to be happy also, because so many people and all the different things they do to deal with grief will kind of keep them down, keep them in this sad place. And it's, I don't want you to stop grieving. I don't think people do stop grieving, but I do believe that you can be happy again. So I signed up for the program, and I'm now a certified Happy for No Reason trainer. And the book has just been incredible in my life, and the changes that it allowed me to make and the ways that I can help other people. And the Grief and Happiness Alliance was birthed from that. And the people come every week, we get together, and I'll suggest something for them to write about, and they'll write for a while. And then we all talk, share what we wrote, And then I'll use either one of the happiness practices from Marcy's book, or I've been doing a lot more research on happiness, and there's so much done on it right now that it just makes you happy to to read it and look through it. So I'll just find whatever strikes me at the time that would be good for that. So I highly recommend her book, Marcy Shimoff, Happy for No Reason. And I know it made a big difference in my life, my grief process, and how I help others to deal with grief.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. And for everyone who's watching and listening, I will include also in the show notes the book that Emily has just mentioned, just for reference in case you want to check that book out. So yeah, thank you once again, Emily, for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And you know, it's wonderful to hear the different events that transpired one after another to inspire yourself to do what you do today. And I find those kind of experiences, certainly to hear them from other people, so powerful. And it's really nice to hear that it made a huge impact on you. So thank you once again for sharing that. Now, Emily, of course, losing one spouse can in itself be an extremely heart-wrenching experience. You sadly, as I mentioned in the introduction, went through that experience twice. With your permission, I wanted to ask, and I was wondering if you had found any similarities or differences in the way you handled your grief on both these occasions.
Oh, absolutely. Jacques died after we'd been married 22 years, and Ron died after we'd been together for 10 years. We had been married for 6 years of that 10. And they were as different as they could possibly be. If somebody would have asked me when I was younger who I'd married, neither one of them would come up in the picture for me, you know. But they were both great people. Jacques was a philosophy professor, and his specialty was bioethics, and he dealt mostly with the ethics of living and dying. So we had lots of conversations about living and dying and what people did. And so it was very intellectual kind of relationship. But he also was an incredibly happy person and loved to sing and act. So when he wasn't teaching at the college, he'd be performing in theaters and other places where he could sing, beautiful singing voice. Ron, on the other hand, was brilliant. 3 master's degrees, an incredible history of doing kind of miraculous things throughout his life. And then after he'd been doing all those things, he felt that he wanted to be a minister. So he went through the Holmes Institute to become a religious science minister. And by the time I knew Jacques, he had become atheist. And then I go from an atheist to a minister. So they were really different there. Jacques was short, Ron was really tall. Jacques was white, Ron was black. They were just as different as they could be. But they, besides having me in common, the other thing they had in common is they both had died from the same thing. And when I met Ron, we had no idea that he had what was going on. But they both had congestive heart failure, which led to renal failure, kidney failure, which led to dialysis. And they both dealt with it for 2 years before they died. So I learned much from shepherding Jacques through the process that I could apply with Ron. But because their philosophies were so different, the whole attitude was different. Now, Jacques was this man who every day he was dealing with death. That was his thing. And about an hour before he died, he'd gotten weaker and weaker, but he still was very cognizant. And actually, he wrote a textbook called Ethics, Theory, and Practice, which is still used all over the world. And he would have to do a revision of the book every couple of years because it came out in 1975. That's how long that book has been around. And he was in the process of doing a revision of the textbook during that last 2 years of his life. So we worked on it a lot together because he had real problem typing. He'd always been able to do that very easily before, and we'd have discussions and I'd help him. And on a Friday morning, he completed it. And it was the first time we got to submit the book electronically. So we completed it. We sent it off. The editor called. We celebrated. It was wonderful. And then I fixed him lunch before taking him to dialysis. And when we were sitting there, he said, "Am I going to get better?" And I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't recognize that all this time he'd been going through all these medical procedures and everything else because he thought the doctor was going to make him well. And integrity is very important to me. And I had to say no. And he died about an hour after that. It was like he realized, why am I going through this? And that was it. He was gone. With Ron, we lived very much in the moment. Everything was really pretty positive for us. We were very supportive, very creative. We did wonderful things. And through the whole process, he didn't complain. He would tell me when he had issues because he had some incredible physical issues that went along with what was happening to him. So it wasn't like he was keeping me in the dark. We would talk about him, but he didn't complain. He wasn't sad. He was perfectly comfortable with realizing that what he was going through was leading to death, and he was okay with that. And the last week of his life was absolutely incredible, just really beautiful. So they couldn't have been more different. The two experiences couldn't have been more different. But the underlying thing through both of them, two things, love, deep love, and happiness. We were happy, very happy together with both my husbands. And after Ron died, and I was thinking about it, and I especially going into the Happy for No Reason training program, I thought that probably the most important thing that I can remember from both of them is them telling me that they wanted me to be happy. There would be a point when we weren't together anymore, and they didn't want that to steal my happiness. And I took that as kind of an inspiration to not just be happy for me, but to do what I could to spread that happiness.
Well, Emily, I'm sure, or I can only imagine, I begin to imagine how emotionally it must be for you to even talk about those experiences even today. So I appreciate you being so open for the benefit of this conversation. Thank you so much. What I wanted to ask you next, Emily, was something in relation to one of your passions and your skills, which is, of course, in writing. And I know you are someone who absolutely adores writing. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you hold a master's in English with a concentration in writing. What would you say it is about writing that you find so inspiring?
I started to say magic, the kind of magic that comes about with writing. It's because in life, all of us have something that's referred to as something like the monkey mind or the voice in your head that can really get in the way of your life because it can just take over. It's, I could do this, I could do this. I picture it as something kind of bouncing around inside my skull with going lots of different directions at the same time. And when you're dealing with something like grief, it can start this big laundry list of all the reasons that you shouldn't be happy, all the reasons that you can't go on, all the reasons that life is terrible. You know, all those things can pop up with that. But when you write about it, and I highly encourage journaling. I did a lot of journaling, or do a lot of journaling. When you write about it, it's not that it tames the monkey mind, but it kind of gives it a break so that you can be focused. And if I'm concentrating on, for instance, wanting to do something that would make me happy, I think it's boring to the monkey mind. And I focus on that, and it makes a really big difference. And then the process of actually putting something down on paper makes it real. while all this monkey mind stuff isn't real. It's just stuff. So and in the writing, I become inspired to do other kinds of writing, to do other things. It's where my creativity and all the things that I do in life comes from, essentially, is the explorations that I do in writing.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, even from my own personal experience, I've always been someone who has thoroughly enjoyed writing from a young age, actually. I remember from the age of 15 and 16 when I was studying in high school. And I was never really a studious person, but I remember really enjoying English language classes. There was something about engaging in the written word, trying to be creative with the written word that sparked something inside of me that hasn't left me to this day. So I can completely relate. Even in these last 7-10 days, actually, I've had a few projects going where I had to write for them. And some projects took quite a few hours. But for me, it doesn't feel like work when you're writing, because it's something that I enjoy so much. And I was wondering, when you are taking on projects such as your book, which we're going to come on to shortly, did you find a similar experience when writing? Were you able to flow through it quite effortlessly, or did you have moments where you had struggles? Because I certainly have struggles sometimes as well. As they say, the writer's block just comes out of nowhere. I'd love to get your take on your writing experience for your book.
Well, I discovered that once I could focus on, like, the with this book, there are 26 chapters. So that's 26 different subjects is the way that I wrote it. And some of them just easily flowed out. I didn't even have to think about it. The chapter just came. Others were on things I really wanted to write about, but I either wasn't as familiar with or didn't know the answer or know what I wanted to share. And when that would come up, I would just get online and start researching, and not the kind of research that you do to write research papers or that sort of reaching, researching, but seeing other people's perspectives on whatever the subject is and reading about what they think or what they do to deal with it. And I find by the end it comes kind of to a natural termination when I feel like I get it now. And if I start writing like right then, it just flows out. But it doesn't always start that way. And that's okay, because I know it will eventually break open and I'll be able to write what my heart desires as opposed to my monkey mind.
Yeah. And for everybody who's watching and listening, just a quick reminder, that book that we just referenced was, of course, Emily's book. And I'll remind you of the name. So it's Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief, A Comprehensive Guide to Reclaiming and Cultivating Joy and Carrying On in the Face of Loss. And as I mentioned in the beginning, in the introduction, I will include a link to that book in the show notes on the YouTube and audio podcast descriptions. So please do go check out that link, guys, if you want to learn more about Emily's book. Emily, I want to just stay with writing for a moment, because you mentioned a few moments ago the power of writing, especially in dealing with something like loss and grief. And I know that you help a lot of people navigate through their path of loss and grief through writing. You help them through writing. When you embarked on this initiative, I was wondering if you could share with us the reactions that you got from the people. How did they acclimatize to using writing to help them get through their pain?
I always have created different things that I use for writing. Frequently, I'll have something just come off the top of my head and it turns out to be perfect for that group for that day. But there are other things, like there's one exercise in particular that the response, I do always do it early on with people when I'm working with them, because the response is profound to it when they do this practice. And it's something I highly recommend to anybody. And that practice is to write a letter to your loved one who has transitioned and say whatever it is that you need to say. And it can be anything from an apology to a gratitude, whatever it is that comes out, just write it until you're done and sign it in a way that you would a love letter to your loved one. And then immediately after that, write another letter. And that letter will be from your loved one to you. And I haven't had anybody yet that wasn't surprised by what came out in that letter and grateful for what came out in that letter. So I encourage them to do that, like to get started with me. That's a really good way to start. But then when things happen, like if a birthday or an anniversary or a particular memory, you drive by a place that something significant happened that triggers you, take that as an opportunity to write a letter. And with me, with having two husbands, them being separate. You know, it's not like I'm just dumping all my grief into one category, but I can keep them in my own feelings, my own relationships with them by doing that. But it's also helped me with things like my parents, my sister, my friends, my aunts and uncles. At some point, I've written just about everybody a letter now, and it's pretty fascinating to see how that all works out.
Yeah, that's very moving. As you were speaking and explaining the idea of writing letters, both from yourself to your loved one and the loved one to yourself, it's quite moving. These are things you normally see and hear in things like movies, but you never really think to actually practice it yourself in real life. And I just thinking about it, it's quite a powerful thought even to have, to write to someone who's no longer with you. And I actually wanted to ask you this next question a bit later on, but I'm going to bring it forward to ask you now, because it's quite fitting to what we're just speaking about. And what I wanted to ask you was, over the last few years, about 10, 15 years, so the first person I'd say in my family who passed away was my grandmother, quite a few years ago in the mid-90s, and then my great-grandfather passed away. And then it was my mother's sister who passed away, and her second sister passed away within the last year or so. And the more deaths we have in our family, you then start paying more attention to a scenario where you lose someone who's very, very close to you. So I have cousins in my generation who have lost their parents, but we have never experienced that ourselves. So there's only one or two cousins in our family who've gone through that. And I can only begin to imagine the pain and grief that they went through and are still going through today. So my question to you would be, from your experience of helping so many people and also your own loss in your life, how does one prepare for such a situation of losing an extremely close member of their family, such as, say, a sibling or even a mother or a father?
I believe that if you know somebody is in the process of transitioning, it's very important to listen to them. You know, you can talk to them, but it's very important to listen to them. And I think if you write down the kinds of things that they're telling you, that can become a comfort to you, or just a feeling good that you've got that knowledge that you didn't have before. And that can be a really good thing to do. When Ron died, I know that one of the first things I thought of was that we left nothing unsaid. So it wasn't like, oh, if I'd only said this, or oh, if he'd only told me about that. It was very comforting and easier to deal with by having that. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't have an opportunity to do something like that, because the death can be tragic and sudden, a workplace accident. One of our friends, actually the best man from our wedding when I married Jacques, was killed in a head-on car collision on his way home from our house. And those are things that you didn't get a chance to listen or say what you'd like to. So writing can really come in handy then, where you work it through yourself without the interference of your monkey mind by just writing it out. Nobody has to read this writing. You can burn it when you're through, whatever you do. It's the process of the writing that really helps. But I think one thing to think about if you find yourself in that situation is to be honest with yourself, to be caring with yourself, because you can't take care of anybody else if you don't do adequate self-care. And that really helps a lot. And leave nothing unsaid. If there's something you always wanted to tell your aunt, tell them. If there's something you always wanted to know about your uncle, ask him. Have those conversations when you can have them instead of regretting that you didn't do it when you could.
Yeah, no, definitely food for thought. And thank you so much for those wise words and your advice. I really appreciate it. Now, Emily, we were, as you know, speaking off air over the last few weeks over email in preparation for this conversation. And through these conversations that we had, you mentioned that whilst being on this path of helping others, there was a period in which you began to realize the differences in how people reacted to loss. Could you perhaps share some of these examples and also perhaps share how you yourself navigate your way through helping people when their reactions to loss is quite different? How do you negotiate those different scenarios?
Okay, you've got two big questions there.
Well, we can just answer the first one if you wish.
And the first, remind me, the first one was...
Yeah, so as I was saying, when you embarked on the path of helping others, you noticed that the way in which people dealt with loss was different. Not everyone was the same. How did you negotiate those differences when helping others?
Okay. With that, it recognized that people aren't the same. And that... don't judge them. Because I've had people, I'll give you an instance. After Jacques died, we were very active in the community. We actually owned a theater and school of arts, and there was an event that came up there that I really wanted to go to, and I hadn't really been out yet. And one of our friends, a mutual friend that Jacques and I had, was a doctor. He wasn't a doctor that took care of Jacques, but he always seemed to be at the hospital when we were there or whatever. So we spent a lot of time with him and we had a really good relationship. And he called me and he said, you know, I know how active you are in the community. And he said, I imagine that it might be tough to go places by yourself, but if you ever want a companion to just take you, I would be happy to do that. And I just thought that was such a wonderful gift. And it, sure enough, something came up not long after that phone call. So I contacted him. He said, I'd be happy to do that. And we went together to the event. And we couldn't possibly have looked like we were on a date. You know, he was talking to people that he knew there, and I was talking to people that I knew. And it was like a ride from a good friend. And I got to one point where I had my back to this group of women, and they were talking about the fact that Jacques had died so recently and how could I possibly be dating already? And I thought, give me a break. I almost turned around and told them what I thought. And I thought, no, that would be judging them. And they know not what they do when they do something like that. I knew I wasn't on a date. I knew I was doing what was best for me and what Jacques would have loved for me to do. And it was not my business what they thought about it. So when you can eliminate judgment in a situation of, and we judge ourselves too, you know, oh, I shouldn't be doing that. Or how could I possibly think that at this point? Don't judge yourself and don't judge anybody else about it. And that can make a huge difference in how things are done. For instance, if you want to say something to someone who's grieving to do what you think would provide comfort for them, think about what you say before you say it and try saying it to yourself. Like if somebody came up to you and said, oh, you can get married again. That, you know, it's no big deal. That's the last thing that you're talking about at that time. But getting angry or judging that person isn't going to help you. And if you can reflect it somehow back to them, you can get into an interesting conversation. So it's very important to not say anything to somebody that you wouldn't be comfortable hearing yourself. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, no, it does. Thank you so much. Now, when I asked you the initial question, I apologize. I probably shouldn't have mixed two questions in one. I'm just coming back to the question now. Yeah, it's okay. We don't have to answer that one because I think it was very closely linked anyway to the first one. And I think you answered much of it anyway, okay. With your response. So thank you for that. Now, Emily, our conversation up to now has been somewhat quite heavy. So with your permission, I just wanted to hit pause for a moment and talk about your passions outside of your work. Can you tell me a bit about your love for creating ceramic sculptures?
I love creating ceramic sculptures. I love to be creative, and I have gotten to the point now where I accept my creativity, because I used to go, oh, I couldn't do that. Like I had myself convinced my whole life, even though I did things like design sets for the theater, I had myself convinced that I couldn't draw. And after Ron died, I took a drawing class thinking, well, you know, it's something to do. And it just came out of me. It flowed. And I love drawing now. I love what comes out of what I draw. And there's so many beautiful things on Maui to look at and draw. And ceramic sculpture was kind of the same thing. I would see sculptural pieces that I thought, oh, that's so gorgeous. I wonder what made them do that. You know, what was in their mind that led them to that creation? And I heard about the Michelangelo's famous thing that he said when people asked him about how he got those gorgeous sculptures out of this marble. And he said they were already inside and I just revealed them. And he actually, when I was in Florence, I had an opportunity to see not only the David, which was incredibly impressive, but see a lot of his unfinished pieces where it's a big block of marble and you see this much of a face or this much of a hand is all that you're seeing. And the rest of it is very rough and chipped around the edges. And I thought that's what happens when you allow your creativity to flow through you, that you're allowing whatever it is that you're wanting to create to reveal itself. And just like I thought I couldn't draw, I thought I wouldn't be able to do faces or anything that looked realistically like a person. And when I start doing a sculpture in ceramics, I don't have usually a clear, I have a general idea of what I think that the direction I'm going, but then I allow it to reveal itself. And I'm so surprised at what the things look like when I get finished. Because it really, whatever I was creating was also in the process of creating itself.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, it's wonderful to hear about your love for all things creative. You love writing, you love, as we're just talking about, ceramic sculptures. And just staying on this topic of passions outside of work, because this is something that I've been contemplating about over the last year or so, trying to allow myself to be exposed to more activities. Because over the years, I have my day-to-day hobbies that I like to do. I like to go for long walks, go to the gym. But outside of those two main hobbies, I very rarely used to venture outside of that boundary, so to speak. So I make more of an effort now to watch performances, such as going to the local theater, whether it be a play or a musical performance, for example. When you're working with people, I imagine there is an element of advising people to stay busy when dealing with grief, because staying alone in your grief, I imagine, can be quite detrimental to the healing process. Would that be correct?
Sort of.
Right.
If it gets pathologic, like you can't get up off your couch and fix your dinner, and that does happen to people who are in grief, then that's not good. But if you can find different opportunities to do different things, experience things in different ways, because nothing's ever going to be the same. You can never go back. And so in moving forward is what people actually do in grief, is move forward. Whatever you can discover on the way to open different opportunities or different interests to you than you would have thought about before, can make a huge difference to do that. I got actually started in ceramic sculpture after Jacques died. And I do ceramics in general too, like on the wheel and stuff, but my passion is for the sculpture. And I had always thought it would be neat to learn how to do that, but never had done anything about it. But a friend of mine said, you know, they're doing a ceramics class up at the community college. You want to take it together? And I said, yes. And the key there is saying yes when the opportunities arrive, instead of try to talk yourself out of it or letting yourself block your good, which people do. But I was so glad that I said yes, because it wasn't something I think I would have thought about just going to, then I was going to go do that right now. But the process of doing it, you get kind of lost in the creativity. And it feels like nothing else does when you're really having the kind of experience that really works for you, and you discover new things and new ways to do things. When Jacques and I first got together, he had a passion for listening to Baroque music. And I wasn't a fan of Baroque music, mostly because I played the flute many years of my life. And it's so complicated to play on a flute that it would be very frustrating when I did it. So I just kind of wrote it off my list of anything I'd be interested in. But he took me to the Carmel Bach Festival and changed my world. I look at Baroque music in particular in a totally different light than I ever thought of before. And it feels really good. And I always think of Jacques when I hear Baroque music. And often when I write, I will put on earphones with some of my favorite things, like the Erinyes that Bach wrote in the background. And that helps me foster my creativity. So the thing is, and that was one of the things that really helped me after Jacques died, when I was trying to figure out what to do. New Year's Eve came. He'd been gone for about a year. And I thought, I'm stuck. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help myself. And so I thought, okay, instead of writing New Year's resolutions, you know, the typical things that you write and forget about by the next week, I thought, I'm going to focus on one thing. I'm going to decide one thing and create an intention for me for the year. And so the intention that I created was to accept invitations. That just came to me, is what I was supposed to do. And I immediately threw up my guard and said, well, nobody's inviting me anyplace. How could I, you know, why would I have an intention like that? It's not going to happen. And that was my monkey mind talking. And I took a deep breath. I meditated on it a bit and realized that that was what I was supposed to do. And as soon as I committed to accepting invitations, invitations started coming to me. And I had experiences I never would have thought about having before in my life. Just briefly, I'll give you a few of the things that happened. I was invited to be on the editorial board for the newspaper, and it was a very large newspaper, and it was a year-long position, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I never would have thought about that. Jacques was on the bioethics committee at the local regional center, the people that they call in when somebody didn't have somebody to make decisions for them and they needed somebody to do that. And they had a community person position on there, and Jacques had been on it in his professional capacity. But somebody from the committee called me and said, I know you can't take Jacques' position because that's a professional one, but we need lay people on there too. And would you like to be on that committee? Again, absolutely fascinating. I had a friend ask me what I was going to do for the summer. And I said, I don't know, what are you going to do? And she goes, well, I'm taking my sister to South Africa. And I said, oh, I'd like to go to South Africa. And she goes, okay, come with us. And I did. And it was amazing. I became, I also, one of the things I've done in my life was a nurse that was a long time ago, but I was going to a trainer and he was an ultra marathon bike rider. And he had participated every year in a race called the Race Across America. And it starts on the West Coast and goes to the East Coast. And every year that he was in it, he'd go in different capacities. Sometimes he'd do it by himself, sometimes with one partner, sometimes in a group. Every time he was in it, he set a record. Except he invited me to be his nurse for him 1 year to do that. And I thought that would be really interesting to go all the way across America going like 20 to 25 miles an hour and really seeing what's happening. So I did that. And unfortunately, when he got up into the Rocky Mountains, really high altitude, he developed pneumonia. So I was glad I was with him because I was able to get them to get the ambulance, get him to the hospital, get him taken care of. And he turned out fine, except for he was very frustrated that he couldn't finish his race. But that another thing, I could go on. The invitations were as different as they could be. They didn't involve the same people. They didn't have anything in common with each other. And most of them weren't things that I repeated, but boy, did I enjoy them in the process. And that really lightened things up for me in a way that I felt like I could take a deep breath again. And then I didn't have to worry about what was going to happen in my future. Just know that I was going to have a future and it was going to be good because that's what I wanted.
Amazing. Thank you so much for going into detail with that. I really appreciate it. In fact, you're going into detail with every question, which I absolutely love. It is literally interview gold at the moment. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Emily, I wanted to switch gears slightly and talk about your podcast because you are, of course, the host of the Grief and Happiness podcast. And you know, I love and admire the fact that you are involved in so many different activities in trying to share and promote this message of yours in how to deal with loss and grief appropriately. What's been your experience of using the medium of podcasting for a subject such as this?
I think it's phenomenal, actually. I think people don't talk enough about grief and what they're experiencing and what happens. So often they feel that they don't have anybody to listen to them. But when they can hear somebody else talk about their experience, they can go, oh, I'm not crazy or I'm not so weird after all, because that's what I'm feeling. And they're perfectly normal, so it's okay. And when I first came up with the concept for it, I really looked at it because so many people told me that grief and happiness was an oxymoron. You know, they didn't go together in any way. And that was what I was kind of trying to disprove. And so I thought, who am I going to have for guests? I just wasn't sure who that was going to be. But I finally just said, okay, I'm doing it. And the guests have just come to me. My podcast is a little over a year. It started end of October last year. And in January, I will be hosting my 100th interview on my podcast. And I have also been on over 100 podcasts. And by talking about a subject that a lot of people kind of consider taboo, it opens doors and opens minds to people. And I've been amazed at the kind of people that come onto my podcast as a guest. As a matter of fact, Marcy Shymoff, who wrote Happy for No Reason, had a webinar where she was telling people about the Happy for No Reason training program. And she asked me to come on so she could interview her, so she could interview me about what I had done with what I'd learned in her program. And as we were talking, I mentioned something about my podcast, and she goes, I want to be on your podcast. Okay. So she's been on my podcast, and she was one of my number one dream guests that I would love to have. And she asked to be on my podcast. So, and I have all different kinds of things, that anything that you can think of related to death. Soldiers with PTSD issues. That's a big loss. And I had somebody that wanted to come on and talk about that. And it was really good for people to hear something that's not very understood. People whose children have died from suicide, people whose family members have had untimely deaths through some catastrophe that you never would have been able to think about. Like the one of the people that came on was the sommelier, not sommelier. She was the wine purchaser for the Windows on the World restaurants that were at the top of the World Trade Center. And she happened to be off with helping a friend of hers get ready for her wedding that week. So she wasn't there when it happened. But normally she would have been there, and she lost tons of friends, employees, people, customers, tons of people. And talking to her was really profound, because you were listening to that story. A lot of us have heard about 9/11, but we haven't been seeing it so much from a personal perspective, and what kind of grief that kind of trauma can bring to you. So I've had no problem getting people to be on my podcast, and have had just wonderful conversations. And I've had people tell me that they are so happy that they found it, because it gets them to think about things that they'd never thought about before, never even considered before, and they felt better that they did.
Yeah. Well, Emily, I'm so happy and glad to hear that the podcast is going so well for you. You're enjoying it, and congratulations on reaching that 100 episode milestone. It's a phenomenal achievement, and it just shows how consistent you've been in the process. Because certainly from my experience doing a podcast, it sometimes you do need that extra motivation sometimes just to carry on. Booking in guests and researching, finding guests. And I do find it challenging sometimes. So I really appreciate it when I hear success stories from people like yourselves, who have really stuck at it and reached that 100 episode milestone. So congratulations again. Phenomenal achievement. And I wish that it continues going from strength to strength, and that you continue enjoying the process as well. And I'll certainly begin now to start tuning in to the podcast for sure. I'll certainly put that on my list of things to do.
And yeah, one thing that I can add to that I think is very interesting, with doing all this work, I'm meeting people all over the world. And
exactly. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Normally I live in one of the most remote places. Hawaii is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it is as remote as you can get.
Yeah,
I never would have been having all these wonderful conversations and meeting people in Spain and the UK and New Zealand and Singapore, in all over the world. And it just really breaks the world open for me. And I love that.
No, for sure. And you're right. I mean, look, we're having this conversation. You're in Hawaii. I'm in the United Kingdom. There's like an 8-hour difference between ourselves. So you're right, it's incredible. And, you know, the pandemic that we experienced in 2020, which lasted for 1 to 2 years, I think one of the benefits of the pandemic, whilst of course nobody wants a pandemic, but one of the benefits that came out of it was this ability to communicate with people on other sides of the world through online platforms, such as Zoom, like we're using today. And a few years ago, that probably would not have happened. Platforms like this were used solely for the office, to communicate with perhaps colleagues who were not in for a day or two, but not for this prolonged period of time, where we're now able to have full-on conversations for an hour, sometimes longer, through the internet. And you're right, it's It's truly amazing and special. And I'm not sure if we would have connected if we didn't have the power of the internet and the platform that we've been exposed
Probably
to, right?
not. Yeah.
Probably not. But we're having this conversation live on opposite sides of the world. So no, I appreciate you mentioning that, actually, because that's a very important point. And in podcasting generally, especially remote podcasting, we have conversations, but certainly for myself, I really pay attention to what you've just mentioned. So we're certainly in special circumstances. So thank you again for mentioning that. Emily, before we wrap up, I have to mention the location of where you are at the moment, which is, of course, Hawaii. And you're in a place called Maui. Have I pronounced that correctly?
That's right.
Could you give us a glimpse into what life is like in Maui and Hawaii? Because as I mentioned in the introduction, I often see fabulous videos on YouTube of people vlogging their way around Hawaii, in particular people who live there. And whenever I see these images and videos, it really begins to capture my imagination. Every corner the video turns, it seems to be a magical location. Please share with us, what is it like living in Maui?
It is quite magical. I can tell you why I came here. My husband had different jobs in different places, and long before I met him, he lived on Maui for a year and he loved it. And so when we got married, we came here for our honeymoon, and then we found ourselves, and he had still had friends here from many years before that he hadn't seen in a long time, but he'd just be walking down the street and run into somebody who was a friend. So we were very comfortable with continuing to visit. And when he got to the point where he was really getting pretty ill, he said that this is where he wanted to live. And I'd never lived any place but California, so it was kind of a big deal, but I just accepted the invitation and we moved here. And I people ask me now, when am I coming home? And I tell them I am home. I've never felt so at home before. I live in an area called Upcountry, which is on the side of Haleakala volcano. If you ever would have told me I was going to live on the side of a volcano, I would have not believed you. But I do. And because of that, I can see from my yard both sides of the island at the same time. And that's amazing to see that. There's so many beautiful things to see. And anytime you turn a corner, there's something called the Road to Hana, which leads you around the side of one island. And it's a really lots of hairpin turns, constant hairpin turns, and sometimes the mountain straight up on one side and straight down on the other side of the road. So it's an interesting drive that people want to take. And Hana's just a small, mostly fishing community. So it's not necessarily that they're going to go there. They're going for the experience of this ride. And what makes it so special is every time you turn one of those corners, it looks different. There's different vegetation growing, a different waterfall, lots of waterfalls on that road on the way up there. There's a black sand beach that you go by. Everything is just so incredibly beautiful. I recommend to people when they want to go on the road to Hana to not drive themselves, because you'll miss so much. You want to be able to look out your window the whole time because it's astoundingly beautiful. And Haleakala, which I mentioned, is a little over 20 miles. The peak of it, the crater, is a little over 20 miles from my house. It takes well over an hour to get there because, again, it's up a pretty straight mountain. And so they have to zigzag up the mountain and you can't go fast. But you get up there and it's like being in another world, on another place, like you're on Mars, because there's lots of red dirt and everything's soft and no sharp edges anywhere. It's gorgeous, just incredibly gorgeous, and something you would never see anyplace else. The other thing that you won't see more than once are the clouds. The clouds are amazing. The sky's almost always clear blue, unless it's raining, which is a really good thing. But when they're clear blue, these big white puffy clouds that go across are just astounding. You're going to have to experience it. And on our license plates on our cars, there's a rainbow. And the rainbow is there because you see rainbows constantly on these islands. They're just all over the place, and they're big and beautiful and spectacular. Or they might be just a section of a rainbow that looks like a tree trunk that's real wide with black clouds over the top of it. And where we live, Ron and I used to sit on our lanai, which is what they call like patios or decks in Hawaii. We would sit out there, and we're so high up that we could see the top of a rainbow. And so we would say to each other, we live over the rainbow. So it's just, and the fish, one time when I was at the beach, it was a time during the pandemic that people weren't going to the beach all the time, but every once in a while people would go out, and you'd never see anybody when you're out there, which was a phenomenal experience. But there was, the sun was shining on these waves that were coming in that were 3 feet high probably. And I looked at it and I said, it looks like the water's gold. And a friend was there with me, and he said, I can see the gold. But it, so we kept watching it, and we discovered that it was these great big fish that were gold, that were just shimmering through the sun coming through the water, because the water was so clear. When there were no tourists here, you wouldn't believe how clear and with the beautiful shades of blue in the water. Just is absolutely gorgeous. So to see these fish, they were like surfing, you know. They were, every time the wave would come up, they'd be swimming together in it. So there's just tons of different things to see and experience. And the people who live here are so incredibly kind and beautiful people, and it's a magical place to live.
Yeah, no, it certainly sounds it from the way you're describing it. And as we mentioned off-air before we began, it's been on my bucket list for a while, but I've never had the opportunity or the chance yet to travel to that part of the world, to Hawaii. Yeah, you never know, it may happen. And if it does, I shall let you know. And if our calendars align, maybe we can meet and go for a coffee or something.
I would love
tour
that.
Guide, perhaps.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I love to do that. And I've had really cool experiences with that too, with friends that I haven't talked to or seen in years will come and visit me. My podcast, the people that it's produced by Jenny Media, and one of the people that works there as like an assistant to Jenny, was coming to stay with some friends in Maui. And so she contacted me. She goes, I'd love to meet you. So we got together and had coffee, and actually we had lunch, and Jenny surprised us and had paid for it. So I never would have met her any other way. I had somebody come to visit me twice from the Washington, D.C. area, because we were in one of Marcy Shimoff's programs together. And so she came and stayed with me for a few days each time. And it was so neat to connect with somebody like that. Jacques' cousins, two of them, one's in her 80s and the other is in her 90s, came together to visit and stayed with me for about a week. And it was magical. It was just amazing. I got to know them in a way that I never did when we lived on the mainland, because we just didn't take the time to visit each other. So you get to meet all kinds of different people, see all kinds of different changes, and it's really wonderful. I had a student come visit me, because I teach writing at the university, and one of my students actually came to visit me because he was coming over with his family. And so he contacted me and said, can I meet you? So I had him come up to the house, and it was when Ron was still alive. We had the best conversation. He brought his new wife, and it was so cool. So it just opens the doors to opportunities you wouldn't have thought about any other time.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And as you were speaking, I was just thinking about the guests that have been on this podcast. I'd say probably only three or four people I've actually met in person. One was my best friend. The other was a lecturer at university who helped me tremendously many, many years ago. And then there was this photographer who I bumped into in a previous career. But aside from that, everyone else has been remote, people who I've never met. So if I ever got the opportunity to meet people who I've interviewed remotely, that would be an absolute dream for sure. Emily, we are coming to the end of the show. Before I remind everybody of how to follow your work and get in touch, I wanted to ask if there was anything that you wanted to mention that perhaps I've missed out through my questions, or anything else you wanted to mention, please feel free to do so.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you so much. This is, it's been just a great conversation. And I think one of the things that I tell people all the time, they always ask me what the first or most important thing to do when you're grieving is. And I always give them the same answer, and that's self-care. Take care of yourself. It's frequently when you're grieving loss, any kind of loss, you're the last thing you're thinking about. So take good care of yourself.
Thank you so much, Emily. It's a wonderful way to end the conversation. From the bottom of my heart, Emily, thank you so much for taking the time and arranging this conversation. I've honestly had a really enjoyable experience talking to you. It's been fabulous meeting you.
Thank you. You too. I'm very grateful to meet you.
The pleasure was all mine. For everybody who's watching and listening, just a quick reminder of how you can follow Emily's work online. Just a quick reminder first of how to spell the name. So the full name is Emily Thoreau Threat. That's EmilyThiroux. And the last name is Threatt on Twitter at Threat Emily, on Instagram at Emily_Thoreau_Threat. And to find out more about Emily's story and the work that she's doing, you can visit her website, which is lovingandlivingyourwaythroughgrief.com. I'll say that again. So that's lovingandlivingyourwaythroughgrief.com. And also Emily's book, which is, of course, titled Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief, A Comprehensive Guide to Reclaiming and Cultivating Joy and Carrying On in the Face of Loss. As I mentioned earlier, I will, of course, include all of Emily's social media handles, including her personal website and the book link, in both the YouTube and the audio podcast description notes. So please do go check out all of those links to find out more about Emily and her fabulous work. Thank you so much for tuning in to this wonderful episode with Emily. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I have. Until next time, do take care of yourself. Have a blessed day. Bye-bye.